Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Vintage Motocross Q&A. I'm your host, Joe Abadi. My guest tonight is a 13-time AMA national champion. His name is legendary throughout Grand National Cross Country, Motocross, Supercross, Hair Scrambles. The list goes on and on. I can go on so far, we'll never get to the interview. It's my privilege tonight to have as my guest, Rodney Smith.
Thank you, Joe.
Rodney, thank you for being here. And also, AMA Hall of Fame inductee.
Yes, that was actually quite an accomplishment. Totally something I wasn't even aware of.
We're going to get to that in a little while. Right now, I want to get back to the roots and where you began. Tell me about your first bike, where you rode, and what it was like.
Well, I had an older brother that rode bikes. My whole family actually rode bikes, trail riding and camping. And so I always got kind of his hand-me-downs. But my first bike I rode was a Mini Trail 50, I think like most of the kids our age. It was a Honda Mini Trail 50 that my dad had cut down the seat on. After that, I think my second bike was a Mini Trail 60 Yamaha.
And you and your family would ride out here in Northern California?
Yeah, we grew up riding, going camping in the mountains, Stony Ford and Popeye Valley and a bunch of other little places. My dad rode enduros, my brother rode enduros, and I kind of grew up, I guess when I was like 3 years old, riding on the front of them. Oh. Until I turned about 5, I think is when I started riding my own bike.
And your first full-size bike was what?
You mean like a...
like a 125 or your first full-size bike other than the Mini Trail, or there was a lot in between?
You know, it's kind of funny because I was always small, and I had a Honda, it wasn't Elsinore, it was a Honda 4-stroke 125 that was kind of the first full-size bike, but I have to say IT-175 Yamaha was probably my first.
A trials bike?
Yeah, no.
IT, not a TY.
IT-175 was an enduro bike.
Right.
And there's a long story behind that one. Was back in that day, you know, here in Northern California, it's kind of the transition from scrambles and motocross was kind of starting. Mm-hmm. Well, I used to go out and do the Friday night scrambles at Sand Hill, and I'd ride the 250 class on an IT-175 because I was too small for, we didn't have the money for like a YZ-250.
Sure.
And plus, I was too small for it, so I rode my trail bike in the scrambles and stuff.
Now, it seems that most people who go on to have a career like you've had, and there are not really that many, but they shine early on when in their early teens. Who was it that really spotted your talent and maybe told your mom or your dad or suggested to you that you should be involved in motocross or in some form of racing?
Well, there's a couple of different people, I guess I could say. One is, you know, my dad, you know, they all grew up riding, going trail riding and camping. My mom even rode.
Oh.
And we had a real close family friend, Rod Kreese, that actually rode flat track and stuff like that. Was a pro flat tracker, and he was real good on a motorcycle. And we'd go riding with a group of people, you know, groups of people, and there'd be a bunch of old guys saying, hey, where are you not taking this kid with us, are you? And they said, don't worry about that kid, worry about yourself. But I would have to say Al Posey. Do you remember Jim Hartbauer?
Sure.
So Jim Hartbauer and Al Posey used to work for Jim Hartbauer Motorsport in Concord. And Al was real close with my family, and he grew up watching me ride. And he's the one that actually talked my mom and dad into getting me into motocross.
So you get into motocross while you're still in high school?
I was 13.
13.
I remember getting my first. It was actually, I'd stepped down because I had an IT-175 that I was riding up in the trails, going camping. And so then I started racing I guess I didn't actually start racing it yet. My dad bought me an RM80 ride in the campground with all the kids my size. And so then when I first started racing motocross, I was 13, went out to Sand Hill and actually took second my first race.
On the RM80?
Yes.
After that, did your career progress?
And then after the RM80, because back then you could only ride the 80 class till you're 14.
Okay.
And you had to ride the sportsman class, which was full-size bikes. And the only thing I had at that time was the IT-175. So I grew up riding, I actually turned 250 intermediate in motocross on the IT trail bike 175. It's kind of an interesting story there.
So you had some experience on the 125s and the 250s. I believe that when you first came out of high school, that you were actually had a professional license at that point, or you were on the national trail a little bit.
Yeah, actually my senior year of high school, I'd already rode 4 national events that year. I rode like Colorado, Sacramento, Washougal. And I actually earned a national number 69 my first year riding 4 races.
While I'm thinking about it.
While I'm still in school.
Oh, okay. So your national number, for years you've always been associated with the number 31.
Yeah.
I may be getting a little ahead of myself here, but tell me why 31. How'd that come about?
You know, we're way ahead of ourselves on that one. When I got invited to go down to Brazil and race in Brazil, that's the number that they gave me there. And I had a lot of success in Brazil, and I just kind of... carried that number when I went into GP motocross after that into Europe. And then when I came back to the States, I always ran 31 and off-road.
You wound up in Brazil for quite a period of time. You were a 5-time Brazilian national champion. How does a kid from Northern California wind up in South America?
Well, like we were talking, so I got out of high school in 82 was my senior year. So in 83, I went on the full circuit racing, you know, the Nationals and Supercross. So I was riding 125 Nationals and 250 in Supercross back then.
And your sponsor then was?
Yamaha, but I was a support rider.
Okay.
And, the first year on my National Series, the first year in 83, I think I finished 11th overall in the 125 Nationals, which was pretty good. And then in 84... Yamaha came out with a brand new bike, brand new 125, and it just wasn't very fast. We struggled all year of 84. I had a couple good finishes, a couple good moto finishes, finished third and fourth in a couple motos, but the bike would break the next moto. They struggled. Yamaha was, you know, working on building a new bike, building, getting the motor faster, promised us that it would be a lot faster in 85, and we got to Gainesville, Florida, and Daytona and all that, and I think I finished ninth at the Daytona Supercross and 250 class, and the 125 National, the bike was just still super slow, and I got invited to come down to Brazil and race down there and make some pretty good money.
So tell me about the Brazilian stay now. Where did you live? Who paid you? What was life like for you there?
Well, there was a couple of scouts that came from Yamaha Brazil.
Oh, okay.
So I still kind of had the same issue, even though I was going down to Brazil to race. I was still racing the Yamaha YZ125 at the time. But they put us up. They actually hired me and Kenny Keelan. Two Americans to go there. They picked us both up from Daytona. You know, they were there at Daytona Bike Week and gave us an offer. And I decided to take that offer instead of staying in the States another year, struggling with the bike and power. And so I took the offer and Kenny Keelan did too. So we lived together in an apartment. They put us up down there. The first year in Brazil, me and Kenny were struggling in the 125 class against the Brazilians actually still. But the 250 class, we would, you know, win pretty easy. So it became me and Kenny kind of battling each other. Later that year, I actually had a bad accident and broke my wrist and dislocated my shoulder, and I ended up having to come back home for 2 months to get healed. Kenny stayed down there and brought his girlfriend down there at the time. And so when I came back down, it was near the end of the season. I think we had maybe 5 or 6 races left to go. And after we did the first couple, I was getting back into shape. Yamaha brought us in and wanted to know they were only going to be able to keep one of us for the next year. Mm-hmm. So the first thing they asked us was, do either one of you guys want to go home? So if we both want to stay, then they were going to make the decision who they're going to keep. Well, they kept Kenny. And I already kind of had a backup plan going with a rich guy in Brazil that had a team going. Me and him had already been talking, so I decided to stay in Brazil and race for this rich guy the next year. But the funny thing was, the last 4 races in Brazil that year, I went and won all 4 of them. So the Yamaha team was going, what are we doing keeping Kenny, but yet Rodney's doing all the winning? Because I really matured at that time. In 86, so that was 85. So in 86, when I came back down the road for the rich guy, I rode a Kajiba 125 and a KTM 250. And ended up winning pretty much everything.
So you have a national championship there in Brazil on a Kajiba.
Yep.
And also on a...
KTM 250, because Kajivas didn't make a 250 at the time.
Right. So and the factories were, I guess, was anybody interested in coming down there? Honda, Kawasaki,
Honda was
anybody
there.
Else?
Honda was there. Honda had a factory team. Matter of fact, we had a little few problems with the problem at the time, but Honda, Yamaha had a factory team. Grile was actually the Kajiba factory in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And the rich guy bought whatever bikes he wanted. So we rode Kajivas for Grile, but yet he bought all the KTMs. And the Grile factory riders in Brazil actually rode our KTMs.
Now, from what I understand, you had a pretty big modicum of celebrity in Brazil. When I think of Brazil, when I think of racers, I think of Ayrton Senna.
Yeah.
I understand that you wound up on some magazines, some billboards. How'd that all come about? What was that like for you?
Well, when I decided to switch from Yamaha to the rich guy, Pedro Falls, and he picked up a major sponsor, Hollywood Cigarettes, which is Brazil's largest company at the time.
Wow.
And the rich guy owned an editorial company, so he owned 13 different magazines. Car and Driver magazine, teen magazines, 2 off-road magazine, a motocross magazine. So he had all these different publishers, and... So Hollywood was, you know, putting in a bunch of money to that. And then he was exploiting my name. You know, I was winning all the races in Brazil and becoming very famous.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was because of him. I mean, he's the one that made me. I was even in Brazil Magazine one time, or in Playboy in Brazil.
In an interview there.
Yeah. They did an interview on me and a windsurfer and a hang glider. So that was kind of cool. But, you know, I was in the news channel every week. And, you know, Hollywood was the biggest, Brazil's largest company. So I really got exploded big. I became like one of the 3rd most famous people in Brazil at the time. It was kind of different. It was, you know, it was pretty neat.
You've had quite an amazing career. I also understand you are fluent in Portuguese.
Yes.
I would ask you a question in Portuguese, but I don't speak Portuguese. How did that come about? Did you go to school to learn that, or did you pick that up while racing in the country?
You know, the first year I lived with Kenny, so me and him spoke English. And Brazilians, required to take English in school too, so they wanted to speak English with us. So it was really hard that first year.
Mm-hmm.
The second year, when I signed on with the rich guy, I lived in a house with a bunch of Brazilians. So it was kind of like a do or die. I kind of had to start learning it, and it was really neat. I mean, it took me about 3 months to really start communicating, and then it was almost like I couldn't learn enough fast enough. Every day, I wanted to learn more and more and more. And you go through stages, you know. I mean, even by the end of it, all my dreams were in Portuguese. It was even hard to. I kind of forgot English at the time, you know, because
yeah.
You know, it's 24/7 Portuguese all the time.
Coincidentally, the Enduro team for America just won the championship in Portugal. Even the title, there was a women's title in the Enduro that they won also. Talk to me a little bit about that, because I know now you're involved with Beta. You've always been an Enduro guy in many of throughout much of your career. But what do you think about, or what are some of your thoughts on this championship for America in Portugal at this time in the Enduro?
It's huge. It's a major accomplishment for America. I mean, we've tried to win that championship, you know, that trophy of many years.
Mm-hmm.
And Americans have always struggled at it. And in the last couple, 2-3 years, we've gotten a good team. I know what it takes to win it. And they've had an awesome team and putting in a lot of work for it. Portugal is one of the places I've always kind of wanted to go because I do speak Portuguese, but I never made it to Portugal.
Yeah.
You know, I learned it from Brazil, so it would have been neat to have been there this year to see it. It's a really good accomplishment of what they've done.
Will Beta be putting together a team for Enduros in the future?
I don't know. They really haven't looked into the Enduro stuff or the six-day stuff yet. They're more into the hard Enduros and stuff like that.
Right.
So you never know, you know, kind of waiting to see where racing goes.
Right. Well, let's go back to 1988 again. You had a chance, or you took the opportunity to ride 250 Grand Prix motocross.
Well, let's back up a little bit before that even. So
let's back up.
Even when I first went to Brazil,
yeah,
I was known as the Gringos.
Okay.
Because we were the foreigners coming down to Brazil racing against all the Brazilians. It was almost like we were hated a little bit. You know, all the fans were rooting for the Brazilians
mm-hmm.
over the Americans, you know. And over a 6-8 month period of time of us being there and showing all the new jumping and jumping doubles and kind of showing a whole new style of racing, which they were starting to pick up on, we still weren't really liked that well yet. And then when the GP came to Brazil, always, you know, they bring a couple of GPs down to South America.
Yes.
The first year they brought the 125 down to Brazil, it was almost as if now we were treated as a Brazilian because the foreigners were coming over, all the Europeans. So now we were no longer the foreigners. We were actually somebody Brazil could root for that might be able to do good in this race.
Yeah.
Because we were doing better than the regular Brazilian people, right? So at that point, they gave me a nickname called Brazuca. And that was more of an American with a Brazilian heart. Because before I had gringo on my pants. And in the Brazilian 125 GP, I got third that year against all the factory bikes. So it was a pretty good accomplishment. The following year in 87, I was riding a 250 Honda. I was riding Hondas.
Ah.
And I actually won the 250 GP down there. And I remember all the GP people always said that, you know, it was a fluke. He knew the track, you know, all that kind of stuff. So the next week of the GP was in Argentina. And my boss said, hey, you never been to Argentina before, have you? I said, nope. He said, we're going. So I went down there the next week and won both motos again. So that's how I earned my ride to go to Europe and race GP motocross.
How many countries have you raced in?
I counted one time, it was a little over 50 countries.
Over 50 countries.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is absolutely just incredible. Now, after the 88 season, finishing third in the 250 GPs, you did have a ride in 89 as well.
Yeah.
You rode the GPs.
I think that next year. I was right up to third to the last race, or last moto, I broke a silencer or something.
Mm-hmm.
It was a different, I do have to say, like, for me, Brazil, I gained all my confidence. I had a really good team behind me and good people behind me and stuff like that. And when I could have probably, I'd still be living there if I stayed. I had everything. I had everything I wanted. I had stardom. I had money. I had everything I wanted, but it wasn't enough. I wanted to be challenged more. So GP motocross is what I wanted to go do. I wanted to get out of Brazil. I was winning too much down there, too easy. I wanted more. So that's why I went to Europe. But when I got to Europe, it was hard because I went to Rinaldi. He was retiring that year, and he rode for Suzuki. So he was putting together the team, still being sponsored with Suzuki, kind of, and become the team manager and hired me as a rider.
Mm-hmm.
And the first couple of years, I think, was a learning curve for him even because it was almost as if I had to ride the bike how he rode it. So I struggled a lot with bike setup and motor setup and stuff like that because even though I brought my mechanic with me from Brazil was one of the deals, we still had his main mechanic that did all the main stuff on the bike.
Who was that mechanic?
Aldini. I can't remember what his last name was. And then I brought over Pedro Ibanez, which was my mechanic from Brazil. which actually was from Spain, but and they wouldn't let us set the bike up like we wanted to. You know, I had to ride it like Rinaldi did.
Yeah.
And I think over the next couple of years, Rinaldi kind of learned from that. You know, like he had to step back and let us set the bike up how we wanted to do it, because each rider is an individual. You know, everybody rides different. Everybody has different settings.
We just had that conversation with Brad Lackey a few weeks ago, to where we were talking about Husqvarna and how they wouldn't listen to him about how he wanted the bike. And they would say, Heike wins on it, you win on it. Yeah. And he agreed, that's true, but everybody's riding style isn't exactly
the same. I went through the same thing with Rinaldi. We was a head cake. I would come here in America, and they'd send me over a bike, and I'd bring my suspension over, and I'd beat Jeff Ford and him in a Golden State and stuff. And my mechanic from Brazil, that was my mechanic, would be here with me, and we'd have the bike set up, jetted totally different. We'd get to Europe and want to put those jets in there. Says, no way, the bike will blow up if you run those.
Huh.
And we're like, no, we've been running them all winter, you know. They just wouldn't let us do what we needed to do to win. And kind of like, even if I'd go out and set fastest time in practice to get you know, gate kick,
yes,
it wasn't good enough. It was always, you could have went faster here, you could have done this. There was never enough, never celebration, never like achievement. And it just really wore on me, I think. And it beat me down to where racing kind of became a job.
Yeah.
And I wasn't enjoying it anymore, and it was just tough. And that's when I retired and came home. And I came back home and kind of learned how to enjoy just riding a motorcycle again.
So
and,
Your off-road career really began after you left Europe and you got back to America. You became a 13-time AMA national champion, 5-time Grand National cross-country, 5-time national enduro, 3-time hair scrambles. I think a lot of my audience are motocross people, and all those letters and numbers can be confusing at times. What is the difference between a Grand National cross-country and a hair scramble and an enduro?
It's funny because I did a Discovery Channel video with Matt LeBlanc from Friends, and we talked about that. Off-road's really hard to designate what is off-road. You know, motocross and supercross, we know what it is.
Yes.
Motocross is outdoor, you know, natural type terrain motocross track, and then supercross is inside a stadium, you know, hand-built. In off-road, we have desert racing, we have hair scrambles racing, we have enduros, we have six-day enduros, we have all kinds of different types of off-road. We have desert racing.
Yes.
Baja. So off-road's really hard to designate what is off-road, but the Grand National Cross Country Series is basically like the AMA Hair Scramble Series. Same rules. Actually, Dave Coombs, I heard, started the Hair Scramble Series back in the day, and AMA took it from him, so then he started the Grand National Cross Country Series again. In America right now, and I'd say the last 10, 15 years, the most prestigious off-road championship in America, or even in the world pretty much, is the Grand National Cross Country. We've had a lot of the world champions come over from Europe. Paul Edmondson and Shane Watson, Juha Salomon came over, and David Knight. So Grand National Cross Country is probably one of the largest off-road, you know, the major off-road championship. I think so far I'm the only guy west of the Mississippi to ever win it. So it's tough. It's different. It's definitely a different type of racing than what we're used to on the West Coast.
Yeah. You know? Now, at 40 years old, you did something that was historic, but then again, much of what you've done in your career is historic. You won a 5th Grand National Cross Country Championship at 40 years old. My question is this. Your career has been so long.
Mm-hmm.
How did the training change? Or did your training regimen, diet, cardio, how did all that play along throughout your career?
It did change. Training changed everything. Even if we want to go back, when I was a motocrosser, everybody knew me in the motocross world. When I got into off-road, nobody really knew who I was. You know, off-road people didn't really know who I was. Even when I went up and won Virginia City, my first off-road race against Larry Rosser and stuff, they had no idea who I was or, you know, that he was even there.
Yeah.
So then my career goes into off-road over the next 10, 15 years, and motocross people forgot that I actually used to do motocross. So it was kind of funny. But, yes, for as far as training goes, so in motocross, it's more, you were smaller, leaner, you know, you had muscle, but I wasn't as big. When I got into off-road, I found out I need to put on a little bit more muscle.
Mm.
You're out there for 6, 7, 8 hours a day at the enduros. You're lifting the bike out of mud holes, you're pushing up hills, so you need a little bit more strength. Cardio-wise, for motocross, your heart rate's a lot higher, so you do a little bit more cardio there. For off-road, we did a little bit less cardio, more endurance-type cardio, a little bit more body strength. So it does change.
Yeah. You mentioned the Virginia City Grand Prix. Larry Rosler had quite a run there.
Yep.
10 years in a row. When you got there, what happened? I heard somebody gave somebody some incentive to try and beat Rosler. What exactly happened?
Well, the club had put up $1,000 silver bounty. And I don't even know if I even knew about that before the race started. I just knew when I went there, it was a prestigious race that when I grew up, you know, I grew up riding in the mountains. Mm-hmm. So I kind of grew up like an off-road rider. My dad used to ride enduros. My brother was actually a real good District 36 enduro rider. So it was kind of like a childhood dream of me to, after I retired from motocross, to maybe go back and do that race. My brother did it when I was younger. And so it was coming up. And my dad says, what do you think? And I said, you know what, let's do it. So we went there, and I went there to win. I knew Larry Rosser was the guy to beat, and I knew I started 2 minutes behind him. And I actually caught him on the first lap, passed him, and checked out. I was actually the only one to do 5 laps that year.
What bike were you riding?
An RM250, yeah.
Yeah, you've been with Suzuki a long time.
Since 1988, and I stayed with him all the way until 2011.
And you know, while I'm thinking about it, a person with the length of time in your career and the sponsors you've had, I don't know anybody keeps track of this, but who's your oldest sponsor? Who is still with you throughout your career? And what's been your experience with them? I know Moose comes to mind immediately.
Yeah, I've been with Moose since they originated in 94. I was actually a Thor rider, which is Thor and Moose are the same company. Mm-hmm. But something I really did in my career, I took pride in as being kind of loyal. And even to this day, I still have good relationships with all my sponsors. You know, it's hard to jump ship. It's a small industry. Mm-hmm. Motorcycling is really small, and it comes around. So even there was times, I know, like I was Smith goggles my whole career until Smith actually quit making motorcycle goggles. And I remember there was a year that Scott came up and offered me like $2,000 more for the year for a contract. And, you know, I stuck it out with Smith, you know, because they'd been with me when Scott didn't offer me anything.
Yeah.
And over the years, it kind of turns around. Smith comes back and starts giving me a little bit more later. I was real loyal to all my sponsors. I think it really meant a lot. It went a long ways. If I could teach, you know, I was working with riders and stuff like that. That's one of the things I teach is try to, even like, for example, FMF, you know. Yes. I've been with FMF my whole life. And Pro Circuit, there'd be a year that even on the Suzuki, maybe Pro Circuit made a little bit better pipe. Well, you can't just jump ship to Pro Circuit because this year they're making a better pipe than FMF does, because the following year, FMF's going to make something better than what Pro Circuit did.
Sure.
So you kind of stick with your companies and help develop it. And that's one of your jobs of having sponsors. It's not just to get free product. It's to help them develop that product. You know, one of the biggest things I learned one time, I think, was from Don Emler, was, Rodney, we don't want to hear how good our pipe is. We want to know what's wrong with it. Because if you just keep telling us it's good, then we can't fix it.
Yeah.
So they want to hear the criticism stuff from us, you know. So, you know, a lot of people get free product and just want to tell the people how good it is just because they got it for free. They want to hear what's wrong with it. They want to be able to make it better.
Do you still operate the Rodney Smith Motocross School?
I don't. Beta came on board about 3 years ago, made me an offer, and it was just happened to be the right time of my life and a good company, and I researched it. And, you know, they wanted to use my name kind of at the first and work with the riders. And so I researched it and looked back on it, and it was a good company, and it was going places, and it was one of the best decisions I made in my life. It's been a really good job. I think over the next year, they ended up making me team manager. So that's been a whole learning, you know, different learning thing. I told them, hey, I was a racer, not a manager. But
the kids here to train with you.
Correct. So, you know, I always look back at learning Portuguese was really actually a big plus in my career because it made me a lot of money later.
Mm-hmm.
I did have a lot of foreigners come over and live with me from Brazil, Uruguay. Even I just got a call the other day wanting me to come down to Brazil and do a week-long school.
Are you going to go?
So I'm going to work on it this year. I'd like to go down there.
Today, so many young kids are getting involved. The sport's evolved between Supercross, things we see on television, social media. As a trainer, as a man with a career as long as you've had, what advice would you give parents as far as bringing their kids into the sport? A lot of them push them too hard, I think. What would you say to a parent as far as evaluating their kid as a rider and seeing if they really have the talent and what it takes to move on?
Well, when I was working with the riders and training them for 2-3 years, I found myself pretty much working with the parents more than I did the riders sometimes. it was hard because some of the parents do push hard.
Sure.
One of the biggest things I think I realized over the years was, you know, I watch a lot of these dads, because the sport has grown, and there is a lot of money to be made in the sport, and a lot of heroes, and the sport is getting to cost more money. You know, when I got into racing, it was more about fun.
Mm-hmm.
It was something we did together as a family, and it's something I did try to teach into my students and their families, that even something I have to this day, that it's not about the money I've made in my career. Me and my dad and my mom have such a close relationship, and we have such a bond,
yes.
And we have so many memories and stories about going camping, about racing. You know, getting up and, you know, just those memories. That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's about your memories. And I sit here and watch these parents yelling at their kid that they didn't do good enough and that they beat this kid before. And, you know, it's just like, that's just all the wrong reasons. And I look back at it, and at the end of the day, either the kid wants to win or he doesn't, right? Not everybody's born with that.
Right.
And I wanted to win so bad. I mean, when I didn't win, my dad was my cheerleader. I told people, I go, my dad never once yelled at me for not winning. My dad had to calm me down for not winning. You know, he always told me, you better not throw your helmet or make a, you know, a scene. You'll be lost. And I learned a lot from that. But I look back at these parents that are yelling at the kids, you know, we put too much money into the sport for you to give up. And
yeah.
And I'm thinking back, you know, my dad was my cheerleader because I wanted to win so bad that he would point out the good things that happened that day. Even though I didn't win, he would point out the good things and almost make me feel better so that the next week I would train harder or feel better and go into the next race with a good attitude instead of being beat down all week long because I knew my dad was pissed off. You know, it's hard. Today's different. And I think a lot of that is because of the competition, because of the money that's out there to be made. And, you know, it's a small industry for people. You can almost win the lottery easier. So my point is to these parents that are getting these kids involved in racing and stuff like that, enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
Enjoy it. Because if you're out there, if you're not enjoying it, it's not worth it.
Who were some influences on you in your career growing up? Who did you look up to as far as riders go, their style, what they did?
Well, obviously in the beginning years, you know, my dad and my brothers and stuff like that. And when I first got back in, when I got into motocross when I was 13, I could only ride mini bikes for a year and I turned 80 expert real quick. And I went from 250 novice. The funny story we could really back up is my dad never let me have a 125 until I would turn pro. So I never, he said the 125 class was too dangerous because there were a bunch of kids, you know, didn't know what they were doing. So I rode 250 novice, 250 intermediate, and turned 250 expert, which actually I did it all in 1 year. I went from 250 novice, 250 expert in 1 year because I had two Hangtown trophies for 1 year was novice class and 1 year was the expert class. So that's how I knew that. But, and so then I ended up riding 125 and 250 pro. But when I got into the pro class, you know, the local, we had a lot of, Northern California was healthy. We had a lot of top riders with, you know, Schultz, Magoo, Wasix. And one of my biggest heroes was Donnie Cantalupi. And, you know, it's funny because later in the years, he was a factory Yamaha rider when I was a Yamaha support rider. And he was always helping me out a little bit here and there. I mean, he didn't know what he was doing for me, but, you know, he was always there for me. And I don't think he even knew it.
And it's such an incredible thing, too, when someone's just, like, you're 13 and maybe Cantalupi's 18.
Yeah.
But that's a world of difference. They're a whole lap around everything ahead of you, you know?
Yeah, they were, you know, it was just my dream to be in the same race with him. And I remember my very first pro race, I actually pulled the hole shot at Sand Hill one day, and him and another guy were behind me, and they both clipped bars and ran into each other, whatever, and they ended up taking me out. So we all three fell, and it was pretty cool that I was so stoked I got taken out by my hero. You know, I wasn't mad. I should have been mad, but I wasn't. It was pretty funny.
When was the last time you suited up for a pro race?
It's been a while. I've done some vintage stuff. I went over to England, did that vintage race. I did the vintage one in New York. As far as, it's probably been about 3 or 4 years now.
Okay. So, in 2017, you get a call from Beta.
Take that back. I did the two-stroke national at Glen Helen two years ago for Beta, and I won it, yeah.
On a Beta, and you won.
On Beta, yeah. That was pretty cool.
Let's talk more about Beta and what's happening there. In 2017, you went to work for them as a race manager. How's the bike progressed? How's the team progressed? Tell me about maybe some of the talent you have there and what direction you're going to go in.
The team's been doing really well. I can't say it's all been me. I mean, Beta's been doing a great job and they've been progressing over the years. And I just happened to come in at the right time where they're growing. And we put together a pretty good, Tim Pilch is the owner of Beta America. And, you know, him and his brother run the place in Paso Robles, Frank. And they do a great job. It's a really cool company to be working for. They love racing. We've been building the race team each year. Last year I had 8 factory riders and 6 support riders. So it's a lot to deal with. It's, you know, getting sponsors and all that kind of stuff. So it's been a whole new learning curve for me. But they're healthy. They're strong. Beta's coming. We're KTM 15 years ago.
That's good. That's
so
great.
It's really neat to be a part of the company at that time.
In 2015, you were inducted into the AMA Hall of Fame. I was there in Orlando that weekend on other business. I remember you being there.
Yeah.
What an exciting evening it was. I remember seeing you being inducted. Such greats were there as Tom White, Malcolm Smith, Keith McCarty was inducted the same night. When you look out over that audience as you're giving that acceptance speech, what is it like to be in that club, Rodney?
They asked me that the next day. We were doing interviews, and it was surreal. It was like, you know, when I was a kid, I told people, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a racer. I wanted to be a champion. I wanted to win championships, you know. I wanted to be a factory rider.
Sure.
Not once in my career did I ever, ever, ever think about wanting to be in the AMA Hall of Fame. You just, something you don't think about. So after, you know, retiring for 2 or 3 years or whatever, and I get the call that I'm being inducted into the Hall of Fame, it still, I don't think, really set in until we got there in Florida and was getting inducted. and how big of a deal it really was.
Yeah.
And to me, it was like I just won my biggest championship, and I didn't even know I was entered in it. You know, it's like you didn't. I didn't even know I was racing for it.
Yeah.
But yet I got inducted. I just won my biggest race because it's like from there, there's nowhere else to go. I mean, it was really cool. And I got to actually do something this about 2 months ago. We had our beta dealer show in Ohio. And so I got the boss, about 15 of us, the employees, all went to the AMA Hall of Fame and got to look at it for the first time. My bike was there and stuff like that. So it was really cool. It was neat to explore that with them.
Yeah. Actually, you got a ring.
Yeah, I actually got the AMA Hall of Fame ring on.
Now, you mentioned something earlier that one of your heroes was a local guy.
Yep.
And I happen to know who that was, and he's here.
Yep.
He's here with you tonight,
yep,
and I want to have him come in and sit down here for a minute. A little surprise guest. Ladies and gentlemen, Donnie Cantaloupe. Donnie, sit right here.
Okay.
Sit right here. I think we're going to have Donnie on the show. We're going to be discussing a few things with him in the future. But for tonight, I want to thank my guest, Rodney Smith, for being here. Donnie, Susie's made a beautiful dinner. We're going to go have a little something to eat now. And I want to thank everyone for watching Vintage Motocross Q&A. We'll see you next week.